Let's begin by checking our levels.
Do I need to put this on?
Not unless you want to. I kind of like to do it headset free, but it's up to you.
That's okay.
So, you know the old, test question.
My name is Jim Ockmoody. I'm the author of a book that's coming out at the end of this month called The Class of 65.
I think we're rolling. Let's do it. You're perfect.
Okay.
What'd you have for lunch?
I had some really good barbecue. I had a split barbecue sandwich plate, half brisket, half pork. They don't sell it that way, but my lunch partner, Gene Kansas, thought that would be a good way to do it, and it was a good idea.
I like being transparent with the listeners. That was a good, I liked it. It was good. Twin Smokers, we'll give them a shout out.
Yeah, sure. It's good.
But we made a pact before we went to lunch to not talk about your upcoming book, The Class of 65, but now we're here and we can talk about it. Let's start. Tell people, let's tell the listener who you are and then we'll get into the book.
My name is Jim Ockmoody. I'm a writer here in Atlanta. I was a reporter at the Journal Constitution for almost 30 years, left there a few years ago, and I'm now doing freelance writing and writing books. And this was one of the first books I wanted to do. I'm a native Atlantan lived through a lot of the things that this book has to deal with the, about the racial transition in the South.
The Class of 65.
It's called The Class of 65. The subtitle is A Student, A Divided Town, and the Long Road to Forgiveness. And it's really an untold true story of the Civil Rights era in the Deep South that has to do with race and religion and reconciliation. But it's not really particular to, it's not just about things that happened in the Deep South. It's a very universal story. Anyone who's ever been bullied or has been part of bullying should find something to relate to in this story, because it's really at heart about a young man who was bullied very terribly because of his religious and political beliefs.
When did you graduate from high school?
I graduated from high school in 1973 in DeKalb County. I went to Avondale High School. I never went to school with any black children until I was in the seventh grade at Knollwood Elementary in South Decatur, and didn't go to school with a significant number of black children until I was at Avondale in the ninth grade, when the federal courts got serious about enforcing the court decision from, the previous decade.
As a student, were you all aware about that?
We were aware about the changes going on, for sure. When I was in elementary school and we had the first black student, when I was a seventh grader, he was one child, very cute, looked like the young boy on the sitcom Julia, Diane Carroll's son, Corey, I think was it the character's name. He looked like him, and we sort of treated him like a mascot. I was a school safety patrol in DeKalb County, and I used to walk him across the street from their home over there to our school. And, if you've got one black child in an elementary school and he's this cute little boy, he's just not, threatening to anybody, that's one thing. If you have a court order coming down 2 years later and they're closing the black high school in your area, with Hamilton High School in the Scottsdale Mill Village, and they divided up that student body between several white schools around there, Avondale, Clarkston, Towers, as I recall, and all of a sudden you had, a couple of hundred black students, I don't remember bad things happening there, but it was a much more challenging situation than just having one kid in your seventh grade class.
Sure. Yeah, big changes. And, people are afraid because they think something bad might happen. That's what fear is, right?
Yeah. And the story has to do with things that happened in America's Georgia, in Southwest Georgia. A few years before I was in school, I was class of 73. My main character in this book was class of 65. And those 8 years make a world of difference in how the attitudes were in the country, and particularly in the South at that time. Because the people who were in the class of 65, they had spent 11 years in public education in total segregation. They never went to school with any black children. And all of a sudden in their senior year, their school was being desegregated. And it's very easy to see how it was a much bigger adjustment for them than it ever was for me coming 8 years later.
And so talk to us, kind of give us the cast of characters, if you will.
Well, the story,
and the setting, please.
The story is set at a place called Koinonia. It's a Christian farming community in outside of America. It's not too far from where the Carters are from in Plains, in Sumter County. Koinonia was an experimental religious community that was founded during World War II in 1942. It is best known today as the birthplace of Habitat for Humanity. The whole idea that became Habitat grew out of a housing program at Koinonia in the late 60s. But
is that why Carter is so supportive of it?
Carter was supportive of a Habitat because he discovered, they approached him about Habitat after he left the White House, and it was very much in sync with things that he believed. And the Carters and their relationship to Koinonia is a complicated subject, and my book gets into that some.
Okay.
I mean, they're very much along the, I mean, they think like the people at Koinonia for sure, but at the time Koinonia was having a lot of problems. Let me back up. I haven't told you about the problems yet.
Yeah.
Koinonia was founded in the 1940s by this Southern Baptist minister named Clarence Jordan. The name sounds familiar because he was the uncle of Hamilton Jordan, who was the White House chief of staff for Carter. Clarence Jordan was not your average Southern Baptist minister in the 1940s. He believed in racial equality. He believed in pacifism, nonviolence, and he believed in communal living, like in his interpretation the early Christians did. This was not at all the sort of thing that you found anywhere in the South, and particularly not in Southwest Georgia in the 1940s. But for a decade or more, the people there in Sumter County more or less tolerated the folks at Koinonia as the community grew.
I mean, was it kind of like a commune type of a feel?
Yes, it was a commune.
Okay.
I mean, not a commune. At that time, it didn't sort of feel like a hippie commune, you know, that we think about in the 60s or the 70s. But yeah, it was communal living. People pooled their resources. And that was their interpretation of what the early Christians did. And they lived that way. And the people in Sumter County more or less tolerated it until the mid-50s, when the Civil Rights era started, and when Brown versus Board of Education, that decision came down to desegregate the public schools. What happened was that Clarence Jordan came to Atlanta in early 1956 and endorsed three black students, I think it was three, who wanted to enter Georgia College of Business, what is now Georgia State University. And at that time, the university system was totally segregated. And by the time Clarence got back home to Americus that day, it was on the front page of the Americus newspaper that a local minister wants to desegregate our beloved university system. And that very day, harassment and violence started against Koinonia. There were about 60 people living at the community then, most of them white, a few blacks, and they truly did live together and eat together, which was not at all the custom of that time. But after Clarence went and did this with the university students, for about the next 3 years, Koinonia was terrorized. There were people who, Klansmen came by and threw bombs at them. Their roadside stand was destroyed by bombs twice. People came by and took shots at them. My main character was shot at when he was out playing on a volleyball court one night.
What's his name?
His name's Greg Whitcamper. And they, for many years, nobody down there would sell anything to Koinonia or buy anything from Koinonia. And they were a farm. They sold eggs. That was their biggest business. And they couldn't sell them to anybody around there except a few black stores down in Albany. So their way of supporting themselves just kind of dried up. And they ended up having to go into a mail order business. They ended up planting pecan trees and buying pecans from the U.S. government and selling fruitcake and spice pecans and pecan candies and things like that. And their slogan was, "Help us ship the nuts out of Georgia."
When Jordan came back, or not that day, but like within like the next, call it, year or so, was what type of reception did he get from his own community, from Aquinnia?
Well, they were all very supportive. They all believed in racial equality. Now, he hadn't warned any of them that he was going to do this. So it was a surprise to them when it happened. But they all very much believed in the same things that he believed in. And they became really this embattled Christian community. And they were persecuted. And it became a pretty big story. It was written about in the New York Times and Time magazine. Eleanor Roosevelt used to do a syndicated column across the country, and she wrote about Koinonia one time. All of the religious publications, Christian Century and people like that, wrote about it. It was quite a thing. And there was the governor launched an investigation of them for being suspected communists. It wasn't just the race thing, because they were communal living. This was at the height of the Red Scare. They were considered to be communists too, and that was part of it.
So how did you find out about them?
Well, I found out about Koinonia because my first job out of college was with the Presbyterian Churches magazine, Presbyterian Survey. It was what was then the Southern Presbyterian Church. They used to have their offices over kind of near Mary Max and Krispy Kreme on Ponce de Leon. And there was a woman there who wrote for me and worked at the magazine, some named Lynn Donham. And Lynn told me all about Koinonia. She was one of these people, sort of progressive Christian types. And she told me about Koinonia, and I just thought it was fascinating. And she went down to Americus and did a story for me at the magazine about Koinonia. And when I started at the Journal Constitution, I started as assistant features editor of the Constitution in early 1980. But I got to write some, too. And one of the first out-of-town stories I wanted to do was to go to Koinonia. And I got to go there in the fall of 1980 and spend a couple of days at the farm and write a feature story for the Constitution about it.
But why did you want to go?
I wanted to go because I was very interested in a story of a community that, on principle, was against so many of the things that people used to take for granted, that was conventional wisdom about race barriers and all in the South. It was a principled community that had stood up against the prevailing beliefs of the region then. I think it took a lot of courage, and it was a very dangerous thing to do. And that really appealed to me. And there had been, and I was aware of the fact that there was this sort of fledgling organization called Habitat for Humanity that had roots there. And so I was interested in it because of that, too.
And at this point, did you know anything about the basic persecution that they had experienced? Or just that there were some consequences for standing up for what they believed in?
I knew that they had been bombed. I knew that they had been shot. I knew that they had been boycotted. I knew that they had been called all sorts of awful names. I knew that a county grand jury had investigated them. I knew that the governor wanted to have an investigation. I knew the broad outlines of the story. What I didn't know at that point was how it played out in the lives of the children who grew up there, which is really the focus of my book. The history of Koinonia, I think, is fascinating, and Clarence Jordan is this interesting, charismatic figure. But this book is not a history of Koinonia. Other people have done good books about Koinonia. Dallas Lee, a journalist here in Atlanta, did a really fine biography of Clarence Jordan back in the 70s. My story really is about these children who grew up at Koinonia and how they suffered when they went into the public schools. They went into the public schools at about the time the Civil Rights Movement was starting up in Southwest Georgia. See, after about 3 years of violence against the farm in the late 50s, that kind of leveled off. What made it level off was there was a feed and seed store in downtown Americus that was owned by a man in Macon and broke the boycott and was selling to Koinonia. And late one Saturday night, that store was destroyed by dynamite. It actually damaged the courthouse, too. And the movers and shakers, the powers that be in Americus, called a community meeting and basically got out the word to the Klan and all the vigilantes that they weren't going to have that kind of stuff in downtown Americus anymore. And the out-and-out violence against Koinonia really tailed off after that. But what happened was that the conflict moved into the schools. You had a group of children who were growing up at Koinonia, most of them from these three families, who had gotten old enough to go into high school. And they wanted to go to America's High School, which was the finest high school in the county. But they lived out in the county, and they had to get the permission of the city school board to enter the system. It was a routine thing. Anybody who asked for that got it, except for these three kids from Koinonia. They refused to admit them. And the parents of these children had to
go. Were they white, black?
They were white. By this point, almost all the black residents of Koinonia had left, because they were so scared that if people are shooting, if Klan's out here shooting and bombing and all that, who do you think they're going to try to get first?
Yeah.
So all the black people pretty much, for their own safety, shied away from Koinonia. And it became a much smaller community. A lot of people left because of the violence. And it became a white community pretty much. These children were all white. In the fall of 1960, they were supposed to start at America's High School. They were denied entry. They filed a federal lawsuit, and it was heard in Macon, and the judge ordered them admitted into the high school. And they went to high school and were harassed and treated. At that time, it was an all-white high school. So these kids, three Koinonia kids, were all treated very badly. They were
because they were friendly to African-Americans?
Yes, but it was more than that. It was because they came from Koinonia, and Koinonia was considered a nest of communism and a place where people were preaching integration.
And because it was a place that had people who were different.
They were different. And later on, in the fall of 1961, the civil rights movement really cranked up in Southwest Georgia. The movement in Albany, all of the confrontations in Albany started in the fall of 1961. And when you had organizations like SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, when they moved in and started organizing in Southwest Georgia, Koinonia offered to let them use the farm as a kind of staging ground. You can do rest and relaxation here. You can come and hold sessions on nonviolent resistance and things like that. And everybody around there knew that Koinonia was basically a nest of what they saw. The white people knew it as a nest of the enemy. And my main character, Greg Whitcamper, he came from one of these three core families at Koinonia. His older brother, Billy, had been one of the three children who had to go to federal court to get admitted into the school. Greg was a year younger. He started at America's High School in the fall of 1961, and it just happened to coincide with the startup of direct protests against Jim Crow in Southwest Georgia. So it just elevated feelings against integrationists, civil rights activists, and people who were in league with them like Koinonia. And they were treated very badly at school.
Well, let's take a 1 second to go back to you as the author of this. Because you're passionate about it. You're clearly invested in the story and what it means. Were you ever bullied at school?
I was never bullied at school. I'm ashamed to admit that I was part of some very low-level bullying on the other end. I can remember in elementary school, I was a bit of a class clown, and I think the same sort of exhibitionist streak that makes me want to tell stories and get attention by being a writer. Back in those days, it manifested itself as wanting to make people laugh in class. And I can remember one time coming up behind a very overweight classmate, girl, and I had written out a little sign that said Goodyear, as in Goodyear blimp, and pinned it on her back. This wasn't a recurring thing. It wasn't like I rode her mercilessly for weeks. It was a one-time thing and maybe a couple of other comments. But it of such things from different classmates, bullying is made. And so my only direct experience with it is as somebody who...
Did you feel bad when you did it, like at that time?
I felt bad almost instantly.
And
because
did,
I saw how it affected her.
Yeah.
When she realized what had happened.
Do you think that that instance had anything to do with your draw to this story? Like helping the underdog? Or at least sharing the underdog story?
I'll tell you how I think it had an effect. I think when I have tried to think about what it was like for all of the white students who were laughing when bad things were happening to my main character, when he was getting spitballs or getting hit or tripped or hit with paper clips or people were urinating in his locker or doing any of the kind of stuff they did to him. When I think about how all of his classmates, many of his classmates either stood by while that was happening or they were kind of on the edge of the peanut gallery laughing, I think it helps me understand that because I was once on the edge of the peanut gallery, and in one particular case, I stepped to the front and center.
Yeah. It's, you know, America, you know, around the time that Koinonia was formed, we were standing up as a country for those who needed help. And so you had talked a little bit about how over a period of 8 years, you know, from what a difference like 8 years can make. And if you think about like when this is going on, just maybe like 15 to 20 years after like our ideology of freedom was out there trying to like basically save the world, how quickly like our entire country changed. And then there's this microcosm that's taking that to like an extreme. It's compelling to want to learn more, not just about like those events, but why they happen. And so in your research, and I'm curious how many interviews you did in this, and we'll get to that in a second, but like, do you have any frame of reference for that? You know, do you have a frame of reference for like, not just the events that happened, but why they were happening?
Well, I'm just old enough to remember legal segregation. I mean, I was born in 1955, and I can remember seeing some of those colored-only signs. You didn't see them much in Atlanta when I was, becoming aware of things, because most of those things started disappearing in Atlanta 2 or 3 years before they did out in the countryside and in the small towns. So, I mean, I'm sure I saw them when we would go down and shop at Rich's in 1962 or something like that, but I didn't think anything about them. But by the time I was old enough for those things to register on me, I would see them when we would go visit, like, where my mother's from in Washington County between Augusta and Milledgeville. I remember going to the Chevrolet dealership in Sandersville and seeing the colored water fountain. And it was, of course, lower to the ground, and I was a kid, and I wanted to drink out of it, and my father, of course, pulled me aside and said, you don't drink there. And I didn't quite understand. And he said, well, that's just the way they do it. And so I remember seeing those things. And then...
to be a little bit more specific, because yeah. I know that question kind of like dragged on, but what changed to really spark the civil rights movement? What was that change that went from like a country, you know, during World War II to where, yes, there was segregation, to basically this struggle? And I think the way you may have the book jacket.
Mm-hmm.
If I can see it. You said... The class of 65 is a rich and revealing portrait of one place and its people at the height of the civil rights movement, a moment when millions of ordinary white Americans confronted the greatest moral test of a generation and failed terribly.
Most of them did.
I mean, how did we get to that is my question.
Well, we didn't get to that because white people failed at a moral test. We got to it because there was a long, long period of black people really forcing their demands for freedom. And it didn't start in 1954, and it didn't start during World War II. It started a long time before that. I mean, you have to go back at least to the formation of the NAACP in the early 20th century, back to, you know, people like W.E.B. Du Bois at the beginning of the 20th century, even before that. I mean, if there's one thing we've learned about the civil rights movement, it's that you can't pigeonhole it into something that started in 1954 and ended in 1968 when King was killed. It started way before that. It was in 1954 that the white people really started to notice.
Yeah. I mean, Du Bois, I'm glad you brought him up. I mean, from what the little bit that I've read, the 1906 race riots here was a turning point politically for who the African-American community wanted to back. I mean, it used to be all Republican support, basically, right?
Well, actually, the switch over from the Republican to the Democratic Party by most black voters actually occurred much later than that.
The seed, though, was planted of like, hey, this is going on and we need help.
No, the Democratic Party at the time of the race riot was not the friend of the black people.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
And at that time, the Republicans were still considered the friend. I mean, the Republicans were the party of Lincoln and they got most of the black votes. And that really didn't start changing until, I'd say, Franklin Roosevelt started it, but it really didn't become a widespread change until the time of the Civil Rights era and really John Kennedy and the Democrats and Hubert Humphrey and people like that in the late 40s and on advocating civil rights reform. But, you know, I mean, Martin Luther King's father, Daddy King, he voted Republican. He was planning on voting for Richard Nixon until Kennedy expressed sympathy for his son being locked up in jail. Jackie Robinson, one of the great race heroes of American history, was a Republican. You'd see him at Nixon things, not at things for Adlai Stevenson. You know, so it that was a gradual shift, but it didn't really become a full-fledged thing until probably about 1960.
The crazy thing to me, I mean, and you're right, I mean, some of these seeds were planted long ago, but how much change can happen over such a short amount of time?
Well, when I think about the 8 years difference between this class of 65 and my class in 73 in the South, that was like 100 years of change happened in those years.
Yeah.
I mean, the difference between what these students at America's High School in the fall of 65 and through to the spring of fall of 64 through to the spring of 65, the difference between the attitudes that they started out with and the attitudes that I had by the time I was a senior in high school in the spring of 73, it's just like almost a different world in just 8 years.
So now you decide to go and learn more about the story. When did you meet Greg?
Well, I had gone to Koinonia as a reporter with the Journal Constitution in 1980, and I had gone back to Americus a number of times to do stories over the years because there's an incredible amount of history in Sumter County between the Carters, between Habitat for Humanity, between Koinonia, and the Andersonville POW camp, which is on the northern edge of the county. There's a whole state's worth of history in that one little county. So I probably went back there 12 times over the years to do stories. So I was very familiar with it, and I did stories on Habitat, so I was back doing things about that. How this book came about was in the summer of 2006, my wife and I were on vacation in Rocky Mountain National Park in Colorado, and I checked my voicemail at work, which isn't a healthy thing to do while you're on vacation, but I did it. And I had a voicemail from a former editor of mine, Ann Morris, who had gone on and become managing editor of the newspaper in Greensboro, North Carolina. And she had just had dinner with a friend, and there was a couple there who lived in West Virginia who were at this dinner, and Greg and Ann and Greg Whitcamper and Ann Gardner, his wife, and they had just gotten back from Georgia from this reunion they had gone to, and they told her this whole story about all the awful things that had happened to Greg in high school, and how 40 years ago a group of his classmates who had felt terrible about what had happened to him as their 40th class reunion was coming up, they had tracked him down in West Virginia and orchestrated this campaign of letter writing. They wrote these beautiful...
I mean, the kids that were urinating in his locker and beating him up and firebombing the community...
No, not those kids. The people who were firebombing the community were Klansmen. They were adults. The people who were doing all of these things directly to Greg were, by and large, other folks. Few football players, few other sort of what we used to call hoodlums. The people who reached out to Greg were, by and large, people who had not done anything to him directly, but had either ignored it and not said anything about it when they knew it was wrong, or they had... been on the edges of crowds laughing and scoffing and
they felt bad and they wanted to rectify the situation.
And they had changed, like so many of us. They had broadened in their outlook. And they wrote him these letters of apology inviting him to come back. And this was the story that I heard in very sketchy detail from my former editor on this voicemail in 2006. And I immediately got in touch with Greg in West Virginia, where he has lived since the mid-70s. And he sent me, he was dying to tell the story. He thought it was, he wanted people to know about what had happened to him in the bad old days, but he also wanted people to know about this reconciliation and how people can change. And he sent me copies of these letters, and they're very moving. And, so I arranged to go see him in West Virginia and went down to Americus and reported a story for the Journal Constitution. And I wrote that story, ran in the paper in the fall of 2006, and got a huge response. It was on the front of the Sunday paper. And almost immediately, Greg and I started talking about doing a book. I would write it, and he would essentially be the protagonist, the main character. But I really didn't do much on it for the next 2 or 3 years because, you know, I had this day job at a daily newspaper. And it wasn't until I left the paper and took a buyout in 2009 that I really got down to work on it.
How different is the day-to-day being a reporter and being an author?
Well, it's very different. I mean, I was always known at the Journal Constitution as someone who did projects and long takeouts and long-form journalism. But the longest series I ever did at the newspaper, if you put it end to end, was probably about 10,000 words. The proposal for this book was 17,000 words. And the book itself ended up being about 76,000 words. And this is not a long book. This is not one that you want to use to stop your door.
Well, I don't want to take out my calculator. So how many pages is it?
Well, it's... the total book with everything, with endnotes and index and everything else, is about 280 pages. But the narrative part of it, from the beginning of the prologue to the end of the epilogue, is, 220 pages. So it's a pretty concise narrative.
Did you feel any type of responsibility to Greg in the way in which you told the story?
Of course I did.
How so?
Well, I mean... this story, to a large extent, this book is his story, and I felt like I wanted to get it right. And Greg read all of it, and the reason I did that was because I was so comfortable. We had a real meeting of the mind on it. We never had any real disagreements over it, and I wanted him to read it, both because I wanted him to correct any mistakes I made, and also because I wanted it to jog his memory. Greg didn't keep a journal at the time, but he's got a wonderful emotional memory. He could tell you, he could reconstruct scenes wonderfully. Sometimes he was a little off about when things happened, but my other reporting could establish things like that. And I wanted him to look at everything, and he really improved it. He was essentially my first editor on this.
Would you read a passage or two?
Sure. I probably ought to tell you just a little bit more of the background, though, of how Greg's part in this book. Greg went to America's High School in the fall of 1961. He was one of several students from Koinonia then, and they all got harassed. And the reason Greg is the centerpiece of this story is because in the fall of 1964, he was the only child from Koinonia left at the high school. He was the only one. And it was the year that everything changed. That summer, the Civil Rights Act had passed, and so you started having black folks coming into cafes and eating in Americus in a way that they hadn't done ever. And that fall, Americus High School admitted 4 black students as a sort of token effort to desegregate and head off more meaningful desegregation. And Greg, who had already been harassed tremendously through his earlier years at the high school, all of the frustration and anger over the changes that were happening in Southern life that a lot of these white kids did not like, it was heaped upon Greg even more than the black students, because they considered him a traitor to his race. And he did something at the beginning.
Don't worry about like the fact that all the other white students were picking on him, right?
Well,
they forgot about that.
Well, he was considered a traitor to the white race because he was taking up for these black students. He would take part in demonstrations in America. So there was a pretty active civil rights movement there in 1963, 64, 65, second probably only to Albany in size down in that part of Georgia. And on the second day of classes in his senior year, Greg, to show his support publicly for these black students, he rode to class with them in the black funeral home limousine. And it let these students out in front of the school, and there was a small mob of angry white people from the town there who were throwing rocks and yelling. I mean, it was a Little Rock scene, really, a smaller version of Little Rock. And the first person they saw get out of that funeral home limousine was this white boy, Whitcamper. And so all of the animosity that a lot of his classmates had for him all along because he was from Koinonia became even more personal because of all the things that were happening in their world and because he had so publicly thumbed his nose at them in that way. He didn't see it that way. He was just showing his support for the black students, but they thought that he was just spitting at them. So he was treated very, very poorly, particularly in the fall of 1964.
At this point, he knows what he's getting himself into.
Oh, yeah.
All right, let's hear a bit.
He's known it since he was 7 years old, and people were riding by and shooting at the farm. He knew that they were persecuted. So going through all this stuff in school, it was more personal and ugly for him, but it was something that he had spent almost all his young life dealing with. I'm going to read a section here that has to do with Greg and his struggle over whether or not to be nonviolent. They believed in nonviolence at Koinonia, just like Martin Luther King Jr. did. And so the expectation is that no matter what anybody did to Greg, he should not fight back because it wasn't Christian to fight back. So this is during his junior year in high school, and now I'm reading. The loneliest time of the day for Greg was the lunch hour. In the classroom, students were usually treated equitably, and teachers kept them relatively quiet and well-behaved. In the lunchroom, however, students had more freedom. They sat with whomever they pleased and acted more like the high-spirited teenagers they were. They always looked like they were having a good time, socializing, gossiping, joking, laughing. Greg had no part of it. One autumn day in the cafeteria, he was leaving the serving line with his lunch when some boys motioned for him to come over to their table. "Hey," one of them said, "why don't you sit with us?" This gesture of sudden hospitality should have seemed suspicious, a spider's come on to a fly. But Greg was hungry for any sort of interaction. During his junior year, he sometimes had sat with Jan Jordan, one of the other Koinonia kids at school, at lunch, but now that he was the only Koinonia kid in the school, he was invariably alone. He tried to make his isolation as inconvenient and awkward for the other students as he could. Instead of taking a seat off to the side of the cafeteria where he could easily be ignored, he positioned himself in the middle of a row of half a dozen tables, his back to the windows, in the manner of a poker player trying to keep people from sneaking up behind him. As the lunchroom filled, students would be forced to sit closer and closer to him, a dance of discomfort that Greg rather enjoyed. Now this boy was asking him to sit with him and his buddies. Greg looked around the room and calculated the risk. He thought that there were too many students, too many teachers, for them to try anything. Maybe they really did want to talk. Sure, why not? He walked toward their table and pulled out a chair. As he was putting down his tray, he noticed something flying toward him. It was Sloppy Joe Day in the cafeteria, and someone had launched one of the messy sandwiches toward his head, bun and all. Greg jerked backward as if he were evading a punch. The airborne food narrowly missed him and struck another boy, who was so angry that he retaliated, not against the launcher, but against Greg, mashing a Sloppy Joe into his face. The reddish filling glopped down his chin and onto his white shirt. Greg was furious. His first impulse was to flip the table and rampage like a bull. He fought back the urge to scream or cry, sighed heavily, and sat down. The lunchroom had cleared out like a saloon in a gunfight. A minute later, the sheriff himself, the principal, appeared, looking distraught, and asked what had happened. "I think it's pretty obvious," Greg told him. "This is terrible," the principal said, showing concern for once. "If you want to, you can go home." "No, thank you," Greg said. "I'll stay." He went to the restroom, washed his face, and blotted his shirt. His chest bore a soggy stain the size and color of a medium pizza. Greg decided to leave it. He wanted everyone to see what had happened. He wanted to wave his bloody shirt. That afternoon, in his English and government classes, boys pointed, laughing and nudging, but no one said a word to him. Greg had ridden the bus that day. When he got off at the farm after school, Clarence Jordan, the co-founder of Koinonia, spotted his soiled clothes, tilted his head quizzically, and strode briskly toward him. He apparently thought the reddish smear was blood. As he came closer and saw that it wasn't, he opened his arms and gave the 17-year-old a hug. A few days later, Clarence approached Greg in the community dining hall and told him that he had been discussing his predicament with one of his friends in Americus, Lloyd Mall, the president of Georgia Southwestern College. It's one of his few friends in Americus. Hardly anybody else would have anything to do with Clarence. "He had a situation like this in high school," Clarence began. "A kid was getting picked on, and it went on, and he finally broke and fought back, and they left him alone after that. Now, I'm not telling you what to do, Greg. I'm just tossing it out there. But I've watched you work. I've seen you throwing bales of hay out here in the fields, and I know you're as strong as an ox. So maybe the next time one of them picks on you, not some puny guy, but someone your own size or bigger, maybe you should just haul off and beat the tar out of him. It's just something to think about." Greg was astonished. Clarence Jordan, a prominent apostle of nonviolence, a man so committed to his convictions that he didn't even want Koinonia children to play with toy guns, was giving him permission to whoop ass. Greg was tempted to use that permission like a shield, to go back to school and cold cock the first jerk who laid a finger on him. As he thought it over in the next few days, though, he came to realize that it wouldn't be that simple. "If I'm going to fight them," he told Clarence, "I have to win. They're not going to roll over just because I'm stronger. They have to save face. So if I fight back, I have to be willing to hurt them badly. Sometimes I do want to hurt them, but I don't want to hurt them that badly. They're just aping what their parents believe. I guess I'm doing the same thing. If our cribs had been switched at birth, they'd be me, and I'd be them." As Greg saw it, he had no choice but to take the abuse. The worst was still to come.
Is Greg a victim or is he a martyr?
Well, I don't think he's either. I mean, they victimized him. And I don't think he's a martyr in the sense that nobody ever knocked him down or took him out. When I think of Greg, what I think of is he's a walking example of nonviolence in action.
But, I mean, his community knew that he was there, you know? And he, by the way, that was incredible and well written, and I have the picture in my head, so thank you. But you know, he knew that he was there. They knew he was there. He knew a path of least resistance, and he didn't take it. He put himself in the center of getting the abuse for a reason. That's why I asked. Obviously, it's more metaphoric, but I mean, it sounds like he knew what he was doing.
He knew what he was doing, and there might have been a little bit of a martyrdom complex with Greg. Let me explain it this way. His older brother, Billy, one of the ones who was part of the lawsuit to get into America's High School, Billy only stayed at America's High School 1 year, and he got out of there. They sent him to another sort of alternative religious community outside of Chicago, where he finished high school and lives to this day in suburban Chicago. Greg was the only one of his family who stuck it out at Koinonia. I mean at America's High School, the only Koinonia kid who stuck it out. And I think there was a large part, he wanted to show he was tougher than his brother, to tell you the truth. Part of this is sibling rivalry. He wanted to show that he could take it, that he could stick through it, where his brother hadn't been able to. There were plenty of times when Greg could have left that school and done something else. And he knew how much he made those people angry. He knew what an irritant he was to them. He knew that he was a reminder of all the things they hated about the way the world was changing, and he kind of relished being that reminder.
I like that. What a great way to stand up. What's Greg do now?
Well, when Greg graduated from America's High School in the spring of 1965, a few months later, he went to the most unusual college experience you can imagine. He traveled the world for about 4 years with this Quaker college called Friends World Institute, and it was a comparative study of world religions. He bummed around Europe. He went to Africa. He was in India. He lived for a time at a Buddhist monastery in Japan. He tried every drug known to man, was selling his blood on the beach in Barcelona. I mean, he had a classic late 60s student experience. And he ended up, one of his younger brothers ended up settling in West Virginia in the 70s. And there was, and Greg joined him there. And several of the other Koinonia children who grew up during the 50s and 60s at the farm, about six of them settled within a few miles of each other in the Allegheny Mountains in southern West Virginia, and lived kind of a latter-day hippie, Mother Earth News kind of lifestyle. And Greg became kind of like a handyman, and he lived off the earth and dug septic tanks for people and built barns and did all this kind of stuff. And he was very fortunate. In the late 70s, he hooked up with the father of one of his girlfriends, was this real estate attorney in Manhattan. And Greg was telling him, you know, there's all this cheap land in West Virginia, and we ought to be buying it up because it's beautiful land. This isn't the coal country. This is the beautiful part of West Virginia that hadn't been raped. And people are going to want to have second homes here and retirement homes here. And he went into business with Greg, buying all this land at very inexpensive prices. And Greg ended up, through a real convoluted way, basically took over a lot of that land. And so this guy who grew up, this sort of suspected communist in Georgia, is essentially been a very successful real estate developer in the mountains of West Virginia, which his former classmates just laugh about. Hey, look, the commie grew up to be a developer.
Well, it's hard to believe, but we've been here almost an hour, and I know you and I could continue, but let's use that as a segue for a moment, okay? And to talk about the cover of the book. All right, at least for the high school yearbooks that I've seen, and I guess they go as far back as like the ones I've seen of my parents. And, you know, my father was born in 1941, my mother in 1946. So of that era. Okay. there was always that, like, you know, most likely to blank, or, you know, best dressed, or whatever, homecoming queen. They say don't judge a book by its cover, but it's fun to judge a book by its cover. So let's talk about the cover for the class of 65.
There are two images on the cover of the class of 65, and they get at the heart of what the book deals with. One is in the upper right-hand corner, there's a mosaic of senior year portraits of the class of 65. All of these kids are white. That class was all white. The handful of black students who entered the high school that year were all underclassmen, so none of them were in the class of 65. The white faces that you see there are, you know, classic mid-60s high school people. We're looking at bouffants, and we're looking at flips, and we're looking at, you know, guys with little bow ties and their hair piled back. It's 65, so nobody's really doing the Beatle thing yet. That comes a year or two later. Even though the Beatles were already out, you know, young men weren't wearing their hair like that too much in South Georgia. Greg is in the middle here. Several of the other people around here figure in the story. One of the classmates who reached out to him is a football player named Joseph Logan, who's in the row above Greg. Joseph was a great guy. I'm sad to say he died last fall, but Joseph was this... He was very much dead set against integration and all in high school, very much reflective of the kind of attitudes that his football teammates had. He went to Auburn, became a teacher, taught at a community college in Enterprise, Alabama, started in the 70s having a lot of black students, started changing his ideas about things because he started seeing them as people, and not only people, but people that he was responsible for educating. That changed everything for Joseph. Several of the other people here have connections. There's a guy on the top row here who's no longer with us, too, named Thomas Jordan, who hit Greg, actually assaulted him in high school in one of the key scenes in the book. There's a woman on the bottom here. She was the cheerleader, homecoming queen, Deanie Dudley. She was one of the people who really reached out to him, and she changed because she... So really through religion. She got to be very religious and started questioning the way she was raised. All of these people who reached out to Greg, some of whom are pictured in this cover mosaic, they all broadened their minds. They all started meeting folks who were from different walks of life. In many cases, they moved away from America. Some went to college or lived in military towns. A couple of them got in the military. They all had broadening experiences. The picture on the lower left hand, it's a cropped version of a picture that shows Greg standing with a couple of black students. So this is sort of his other, here he is amid all the white kids he was going to school with, and here he is at the bottom with these black children. They were really his friends in high school. The black kids that he knew from the other side of high school are the ones that he socialized with. A couple of these black students here were the ones who desegregated America's high. Most of them didn't stay around very long. The picture, the reason Greg is posing with them and the reason he's wearing a little blazer and a tie is because he is. It's taken at Jekyll Island in the fall of 1964, where Greg and the black students who were desegregating the high school were receiving an award from a civil rights group here in Atlanta, the Georgia Council on Human Relations. And they had been monitoring the situation in America very closely. They knew what these kids were going through. They knew that Greg, even though he was the only white person face in this, he was very much part of it. And they took them away to the beach for one weekend and said, "We know what all you're going through, but you're doing the right thing here, and we appreciate it, and here's this little award."
Well, it's an important story to tell. It's going to be a nice piece to reflect on, and I enjoyed our conversation today.
Well, thank you, Gene. You can tell I just overflow talking about it.
It's a cool story. It's an important story, and it's one that, you know, I think that it's in one of the reviews or quotes on the book, not a review, but a quote on the book. It's a story that's not well known, but at the same time, it's incredibly well known. You know, I mean, maybe not these specifics, but this happened all over our country and we're still talking about it all these years later. So now go read it. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Jane.